Welcome to today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, March 11th. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker, and here is our first story. Actually, I'm going to start with the first cover photo in large picture and heading Champions Again. The Iowa Hawkeyes pose for a picture with the Big Ten Championship Trophy after defeating Nebraska 94-89 in overtime, coming back from a 46-35 halftime deficit Sunday at the Target Center in Minneapolis. It was the Hawkeyes' third consecutive tournament title. And they are shown with confetti. There's a couple of girls, Sydney Offalter and Gabby Marshall, laying in the confetti, smiling. So that was a great win. Big Ten Women's Basketball Tournament. Okay, now I'll go to our first story. Private school educators worry about AEA funding. Public schools would get allocation for non-special education services. This is by Grace King, out of Cedar Rapids. It is unclear how special education services for Iowa students in private schools would be funded if proposed legislation that would reorganize the funding and oversight of area education agencies is approved by lawmakers. Private school educators also worry how the proposed bills would affect their ability to pay for media and other education services that are crucial to teaching students and are currently provided by AEAs. It looks like the bill allows non-public schools to participate in every program we currently participate in, barring AEAs choosing to not provide them anymore, but it does not clearly state how the dollars will flow through public districts to the AEA to provide those services, according to a letter posted to the Iowa Association of Christian Schools website earlier this month. Last month, House Republicans proposed File 2612 after they blocked a more expansive and dramatic proposal from Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds that would have allowed school districts to spend their special education dollars outside the AEAs. The House bill keeps Iowa's AEAs as the sole provider of special education support in the state. State funding for special education services would go to the school districts, and they would be required to use that funding with the AEAs. Public school districts would receive an allocation for media services and other education services that has been provided to the AEAs, and the districts would be able to choose whether to use that money with the AEAs or with another party once the bill is fully phased in for the 2026-27 school year. The Senate AEA bill, Senate File 2386, has moved out of committee, but it has not reached a floor vote. The bill differs significantly from the House proposal, and it would allow schools to seek special education services outside the AEAs. The chambers will need to agree on a single bill in order to send it to Reynolds to be signed into law. This leaves non-public school officials wondering where they fit into the allocation for media and other education services that is currently funded by flow-through dollars, tax dollars, and state funds that literally flow through local school district budgets to the AEA. AEAs support all accredited non-public schools in Iowa. AEAs support all accredited non-public schools in Iowa. AEA staff support non-public school students who have individualized education plans, legal documents developed for each child in the U.S. who needs special education created through a team of the child's parent and educators. Non-public schools receive special education services from the AEAs, such as occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech-language pathology, and audiology on-site. For other special education needs, such as academic and behavior goals, public school officials work with the private school to determine the most appropriate place for those services to be implemented, according to the AEA. While the student still is enrolled in the non-public school and does the majority of their learning there, this means that some students do receive special education services at a public school. The AEAs also provide educational services and media and technology support to every accredited non-public school. Kathy Walls, superintendent of schools for the Archdiocese of Dubuque, said non-public schools need the bill to clarify how they would continue to access funding for AEA services that meet the needs of students and staff. The Archdiocese of Dubuque oversees around 12,000 students in 44 Catholic schools in the northeastern part of the state, including Cedar Rapids. Anything we would need to pay for that we're not currently paying for would be something we would have to take into consideration, Walls said. The AEA still would be required, under federal law, to provide services to students in special education who have individualized education plans. There are specific requirements for timely and meaningful consultation between districts and the non-public schools within their district, which fulfills the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act requirements, a federal law that makes available free public education to students with disabilities and ensures special education and related services to those children. At St. Pius X Elementary School in Cedar Rapids, students and educators work with experts from Grant Wood AEA who provide support in digital learning, occupational therapy, speech-language therapy, literacy, and assistive technology. Grant Wood AEA serves 7 counties in eastern Iowa, including Lynn and Johnson, and 15 state-accredited non-public schools. Some but not all of these services are required to be provided to students through their IEPs, but a lot of services, such as technology integration, are just a part of continuously improving teaching and learning practices for all students, said Stephanie Sears, principal at St. Pius X. Jeanette Beer, a student support service teacher at St. Pius X, said the services provided to them by the AEA are invaluable. Our teachers can't be experts in everything, Beer said. Some of the accommodations students at St. Pius X are using include speech-to-text options that enable students to talk and for that to be converted automatically into text. This can be important for students with dyslexia, for example, Beer said. The technology also can go the other way, reading text to students and even simplifying it for students who are reading below grade level, Beer said. If one of these bills is signed into law, school officials worry they would lose experts in teaching and learning advancements who right now are just a phone call away. Non-public schools also rely on support they contract with the AEAs to provide. They worry these services could be made more expensive if school districts choose to use another party, an option under the bill. There is increased efficiency in AEA purchasing media and educational support products and maximized savings in group purchasing for public and non-public schools, said John Speer, chief administrator at Grant Wood and Mississippi Bend AEAs. The bills could present pain points for schools if they don't contract with the AEAs for services they discover they later need, Speer said. The pain point would come in October, for example, when a school realized it didn't contract for us for something they need. There's a good chance we couldn't provide that at that point because we would only staff for what is contracted, Speer said. If you didn't contract with a teacher for deaf and hard of hearing students because you've never had a student who needed that service, but in November a student moves in who does need that service, I'm not sure what the district would do, Speer said. Whether it's special education, education services, or media, schools would have to find it from a private provider if they don't contract it with the AEAs, Speer said. That could potentially be more costly. Commercial services is more expensive than AEA-provided services, he said. Hillcrest Academy, a private Christian school in Kelowna, relies on the almost 30 online resources Grant Wood AEA subscribes to and makes available to schools in its service region. This includes resources such as EBSCO, the leading provider of research databases, e-journals, magazine subscriptions, and e-books. The cost of these resources to Grant Wood AEA is $170,000, Speer said. The consortium makes it affordable. It would cost millions if Iowa school districts were to purchase these online resources individually, Speer said. Hillcrest also is a part of Grant Wood AEA's mentoring and induction program for new teachers. The consortium provides professional development to teachers during their first 2 years in the profession. While up to 40% of Iowa teachers leave the state after 3 years, Grant Wood AEA consortium members saw a 95% retention rate among new teachers thanks in part to this program. Megan Walsh, a sixth-grade math and social studies teacher at Hillcrest Academy, said the coach she meets with weekly from Grant Wood AEA ensures her students get the best quality education from her. This is Walsh's first year teaching, and she said she's shiny, squeaky clean. Her Grantwood AEH coach observes me teach. It's a time for me to sit down with an unbiased, completely neutral person that can help me figure out what's working and what I can do better. Beth Swantz is a sixth grade science and reading teacher at Hillcrest Academy who returned to the classroom this year after almost a decade as a digital learning consultant at Grantwood AEA. Swantz said teachers often feel isolated in their own bubble of their classroom. This can be especially true in private schools, where there is often one teacher for each content area, she said. Experts from the AEA make a huge difference by providing training that supports teachers in their classrooms, Swantz said. April Bickford, head of schools at the PK through 8th grade Summit School in Cedar Rapids, said she attributes improved math scores this year to the monthly meetings Summit teachers have had with Grantwood AEA math consultants. On the iReady assessment, Summit saw an improvement from 47 students to 75 students meeting grade level standards in math on the K through 8 assessment. If non-public schools can't access the same level of services through the AEAs that they do now, Bickford said it could negatively impact teachers and the quality of education they can provide students. Our next article, lawmakers seek to aid lifeblood of rural towns, grocery stores. Iowa among states weighing grants to help rural stores. This is by Kevin Hardy, and it's out of Emerson, Nebraska. Corliss Hessler rushes in the front door of Post 60 Market and heads straight for the produce case. "I'm back," she announces. It's around lunchtime, but it's already her second trip in today. This time, she's picking up a few items for the Friday fish fry at the local Catholic church. Hassler is a regular customer and investor in the small grocery store, opened in 2022 as a cooperative. The store provides convenience, sure. It's the only place in town to buy fresh fruits, vegetables, and meats. But it's also a social hub for the northeast Nebraska town of Emerson, population 891, not far from Sioux City. "The store is the lifeblood of the community," Hassler said. "We have to keep our store, we have to keep our schools, we have to keep our churches, and it's all a struggle right now." The market opened 4 years after the town's only grocery store closed. Some 110 people bought shares, which funded the transformation of a shuttered American Legion post into a store packed with fresh and packaged foods. Preserving grocery stores has been a perennial challenge for rural communities. Small, often declining populations make it tough to turn a profit in an industry known for its razor-thin margins. Increased competition from online retailers, the onslaught of chains such as Dollar General, and an aging lineup of independent grocers have only made things tougher. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has tracked the decline of rural grocery stores. By 2015, USDA research showed a total of 44 counties in the nation had no grocery store at all. All but four of the counties were rural. In Kansas, one in five rural stores closed between 2008 and 2018, according to the Rural Grocery Initiative at Kansas State University. No new store has opened in half of the 105 communities that lost grocers over that time. Proposed legislation at Nebraska's Capitol could provide some relief for stores like Post 60 Market. The bill would provide grants and loans for small grocers. It's among several legislative efforts in the region that aim to tackle the complex problem. In Iowa and Kansas, lawmakers have introduced bills with similar goals, following the lead of other states including Illinois, Minnesota, North Dakota, and Oklahoma that have enacted laws setting up funds to boost rural grocery stores. "We're in a global economy and Amazon's dominating, but that doesn't mean we should surrender," said Kansas State Senator Rob Olson, a Republican. For 2 years, Olson has introduced bills that would provide tax incentives for the development of rural grocery stores. Olson said lawmakers should be investing in grocery stores, broadband, and housing to improve rural communities. "If we think about it, and we're smart about it, there's plenty of opportunities, all throughout the Midwest especially, to grow these economies," he said. "The pandemic underscored both the importance and fragility of rural grocery stores," said Jillian Linster, interim policy director at the Center for Rural Affairs, a nonprofit based in Nebraska. After the pandemic, we have seen a lot of these local grocery stores just struggling to keep the doors open with all the economic and workforce challenges we face in the current economy and the competition from the big box retailers, she said. The center has backed bills in both Nebraska and Iowa this legislative session to provide small grants or loans to grocery stores in underserved communities. The hope is that providing money to replace a broken freezer or leaky roof could make the difference in keeping stores open. It's a place where you see your neighbors, where your teenagers get their first job, where there's a bulletin board with help wanted and things for sale, she said. So it's a really important part of the social infrastructure in our small, rural towns. The Iowa bill, House File 2599, passed a committee in February but has not seen legislative activity since. The bill would allocate $4 million over 2 years to a special fund that would aid qualified grocery stores serving or opening in underserved communities. Bill Horak knows his customers. The general manager of Post 60 Market, he knows the busy mom who runs to the frozen foods aisle to find something for dinner that night. He knows the families that load up their carts only on paydays. And he knows when he should check up on someone who hasn't been in for an unusually long stretch. Emerson sits at the convergence of three counties, including one of Nebraska's poorest. The market can't compete with the prices of mega retailers such as Walmart, but Horak tries to at least beat the costs found at the regional grocery store chain 20 miles away and loads the shelves with plenty of generic options. Still, some customers will pay with loose change. Others drop in to rummage through the bin of discounted items nearing their expiration dates. Remote stores like this can struggle to secure vendors. No bakers will deliver fresh bread here, so all the sandwich bread, buns, and cupcakes come in frozen, and the store gets only one delivery of fresh food every Wednesday. But whatever it lacks in variety, the store makes up for in service. Horak will special order just about anything if customers ask. On a back shelf, he set aside a case of Rice-A-Roni for one man, a pack of small Pepsi bottles for a woman in a nursing home, and a case of wet cat food for a woman who feeds strays. One man has a standing order for a case of pickled beets every week. There has been some months when Horak wasn't sure Post 60 Market's doors would remain open, but things changed for the better in January when a storm blanketed the region with record snow. The two-lane roads connecting Emerson to Sioux City were impassable for days, pushing many to try the Post 60 Market. People were so happy the grocery store was here, he said. The pending legislation could help with a litany of items on the market's to-do list. A leaky basement, the rubber gaskets that need replacing on the produce cooler, not to mention the dream of a room to butcher fresh cuts of meat. Named after the town's former Legion Post, the co-op sold common shares for $500 and preferred shares for $1,000. While shareholders could one day see dividends, their investments were in reality more like contributions. Nathan Mueller, who leads the co-op board, said the store just aims to break even. At its heart, this is a business, he said, but really the business is being a service to the community. Nebraska State Senator Teresa Ibach said rural grocery stores, whether they're for-profit, cooperatives, or nonprofits, deserve the state's support. A Republican, Ibach sponsored the legislation that would set aside $4 million over two fiscal years for rural grocers. While the legislation got favorable reviews during its January hearing, Ibach was unsure whether it would advance out of committee. It's got legs and it's got substance, and I hope it does, but we're halfway through the session already, she said, and so who knows what will make it to the floor. If approved, the measure could help Greg's Market in Exeter, Nebraska, about 50 miles west of Lincoln. The store has a honeydew list a mile long, said Mitchell Schlugelmich, who leads the board overseeing its operation. Just before he heard about the legislation, Schlegelmilch said a freezer sensor failed, costing some $2,500 in spoiled inventory. It was a real punch in the gut, he told lawmakers at the January hearing. Catherine Drager says rural communities need more than just dollar stores and gas stations. The director of Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships at the University of Minnesota, Drager works with grocery stores across the state. Aside from the health benefits of fresh food, she said rural stores are key to building more resilient supply chains since they can procure products from a variety of small vendors. Dreger advocated for a state program to improve healthy food access that began offering grants to rural and urban stores in 2017. Last year, the Minnesota Agriculture Department funded 15 projects at a cost of $426,862, though nearly five times as much was requested. "I believe every rural grocery store we lose is at our own peril," Dreger said. "There's so much public good in these small private businesses. That is why this public investment in this private sector is really important. Just as important as money, though, is leadership," said North Dakota Democratic State Senator Kathy Hogan. She co-sponsored a new law last year that made $1 million available to help preserve rural grocery stores. "That money will help only if communities have strong leaders willing to work together," she said. "Sometimes people think money is the answer to everything," she said. "The secret of the success of this is not so much money, but local organization." Republican State Senator Jane Myrdal, another co-sponsor, said the legislation was inspired by the work of grocery stores, communities, and schools in the northeast corner of the state. After struggling to find vendors willing to make small deliveries to remote areas, three stores formed a cooperative that can demand more inventory and better prices from suppliers. "As a conservative, I love seeing that happen," Myrdal said. The legislation required a local match from organizers and aims to pull multiple retailers and community organizations together to stabilize deliveries and costs. People like to say the town of Malvern in western Iowa punches above its weight. Though it's home to fewer than 1,300 people, the town touts miles of bicycle trails, a community garden, and public art sculptures. On Main Street, two restaurants, medical clinics, a bank, a pharmacy, and even a fitness center. But a fenced-in gaping hole is an obvious reminder of what's missing, the town's staple grocery store lost in a 2021 fire. Tom Mulholland was the fourth-generation owner of Mulholland Grocery, which traces its history to the 1870s. Since the fire, the community has rallied around him. Meta, parent company of Facebook and Instagram, funded a documentary short film about the effort to rebuild the grocery store last year. But even with an Oscar-winning documentarian as the director and scores of headlines, Mulholland has struggled. He's faced problems with insurance, finances, and construction headaches that set the rebuild back. When the store was open, it was a hub of activity. People would drive long distances to buy from his meat counter. And in times of crisis, such as floods in the area, customers would hand him cash, knowing he'd get it to the folks who needed it most. Mulholland, 63, could have walked away from the store, but he said it's too important to the community and his family. The morning after the fire, he wrote an apology to his ancestors on Facebook. In an interview, he said, "My great-grandfather and my grandfather, everybody put in so many decades of sweat and tears and frustration and joy, and on my watch, it disappeared." Without Mulholland Grocery, Malvern residents must drive 15 minutes to reach another small-town grocery store or a half hour to reach a supermarket chain near Omaha. The absence of the grocery store is a sharp contrast to Malvern's otherwise encouraging trajectory. Some $40 million worth of new projects are in the works in the town, including public school renovations, a new subdivision, and a new early education center. "We're a growing town," said Jay Burdick, the president of Malvern Bank, "but every day brings a reminder of what's missing." His desk overlooks Main Street, directly across from the empty grocery store lot. "It was the centerpiece of our Main Street," he said, "and now it's just a hole in the ground." Our next story, one person dead, another injured in crash on East Post Road in Marion. Vehicle hit utility pole, went airborne before crashing into garage. Out of Marion, one person was killed and another injured in a single vehicle crash Friday night in Marion. The vehicle was traveling north on East Post Road, south of Hickory Wind Lane, at around 11:38 p.m. Friday, when the driver lost control, according to a news release from the Linn County Sheriff's Office. The vehicle struck a utility pole on the east side of the road, went airborne, and struck a detached garage before coming to rest in a yard, the release states. A male occupant in the vehicle, identified as Demontre Poole, 26, of Marion, was pronounced dead at the scene. A female occupant in the vehicle, Moan Dotson, 25, of Cedar Rapids, was taken by air ambulance to a hospital for treatment of life-threatening injuries, according to the news release. The crash was responded to by Linn County Sheriff's deputies, Marion Police, and fire and area ambulance. It remains under investigation by the sheriff's office. And now I'm going to turn to the insight section, the opinion section, and read the community letters for today. Our first letter, anti-transgender legislation fueled by fear. I've attended multiple meetings at the Capitol in the last several weeks related to anti-transgender legislation, House File 2028 and House File 2389, and it's evident that these proposed laws are fueled by a fear and confusion about gender identity and expression. I oppose this legislation for many reasons, but four practical issues seem especially relevant. Number one, gender identity may be complex, but discriminating against individuals based on it is unjust. Lawmakers need to recognize the validity of diverse identities without imposing their confusion or fear onto others. If you don't understand how other people experience gender, that's okay. Number two, personal beliefs, whether religious or based on ideologically driven research, do not negate the lived experiences of transgender individuals. Attempts to invalidate the existence of transgender people hinders constructive dialogue. Number three, concerns about cisgender men exploiting transgender policies for illegal activities lack statistical support. Criminal behavior remains illegal regardless of gender identity. Legislating around hypothetical scenarios is the opposite of common sense. Number four, transgender men exist. Enforcing restroom policies based on assigned sex at birth can lead to absurd situations and undermines the notion of protecting women's spaces. It's clear from the overwhelming number of comments in opposition to these bills, in both the bill book and at legislative sessions, that most Iowans are against anti-transgender legislation. These bills waste resources on non-existent issues and endanger real people. Let's refrain from crafting laws rooted in fear and discrimination. And that letter was from Ellsworth Carmen of Iowa City. And our other letter is, proposed exemptions imply vaccines aren't needed. While some of our Iowa legislators are debating a need for more clarity in allowing parents to exempt their children from routinely recommended vaccinations, we should not forget that vaccinations are highly effective in preventing some of the worst diseases. In 1900, before vaccinations were available, 50% of children died before the age of 10, mostly from infectious diseases. Every household either had a family member or a neighbor who died from an infectious disease. Back then, when vaccinations became available, there was not much question regarding whether they would be used. Nowadays, most people have not seen nor experienced these dreaded diseases. Neither have the current crop of younger medical practitioners. During my training and residency, I saw a few dozen cases of measles with pneumonia. These cases provided evidence that a booster was needed around age 5 years. I had no patients with measles, encephalitis, with subsequent severe mental impairment, but I did become acquainted with such an individual who was under the guardianship of his physician brother. In my first year of medical practice, a 3-year-old died in my arms due to Haemophilus influenza B. Another patient who had it ended up with impaired intellectual ability. The vaccine became available a year or two later. I certainly had no hesitation to recommend and to use it. Will the proposed legislation include a strong endorsement of the need for these vaccinations? Will the legislators accept some liability for the outcomes of children who don't receive vaccinations? And that letter was from Donald Florey, MD of Clinton. You are listening to the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Linda Marie Dixon of Lenox Fitzgerald, Now I'm confused. I'm sorry. It says Linda Marie Dixon, in parentheses, Lennox Common, comma, Fitzgerald, of Anamosa, passed away in peace on March 7th at age 76. Linda was born on June 1st to parents William and Catherine Fisher of Coggin. She graduated from Coggin High School in 1965. Linda is survived by her children, Matt Fitzgerald of Olin and Mary Nelson of Cedar Rapids, her big sister Susan Gierke of Central City, and little brother Roger Lennox of Coggin. Linda was granny to Lucas Nelson of Cedar Rapids. Linda is also remembered by many loving extended family and friends, with her soul sisters Sharon Weishart and Cynthia Blossom. Preceding Linda in death were her parents and husband Richard Dixon. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Linda's spirit is free. Mary C. Jones Hurt Martin was born January 12, 1927 in Williamsburg, daughter of Edmund and Polly Jones. Mary graduated from Ely High School in 1944 and Cedar Rapids Business College in 1946, thereafter working several years in the office of Pennick and Ford. In 1949, Mary was married to Ernest Hurt until his death in 1957. In 1959, she was united in marriage to William Bob Martin. Together, they parented two daughters, Susan and Sharon. Mary dearly loved her family and her extended family of grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and a great-granddaughter. Mary was an active member of Gloria Day Lutheran Church, including several years of bookkeeping for Lutheran Vespers, Grace Matters, a former weekly radio broadcast. She enjoyed cooking, baking pies, puzzles, card playing, and making greeting cards. Mary is survived by her husband Bob, daughters Susan Martin and Sharon Dixon Miller, two sons Paul and Bradley Martin, sister-in-law Ellen Jones of Ely, and her nieces and nephews. Mary was preceded in death by her parents, two brothers Robert Jones and Edmund Jones, two sisters Margaret Hiscock and Elizabeth Rice, daughter Julie Davis and daughter-in-law Deborah Martin. Mary was a beacon of light, and she was loved by all that knew her. A celebration of life is being planned for a later date. Mark Kevin Grossman of El Reno, Oklahoma, was 68 when he passed away on January 29th. That says January 29th of 2023. I'm not sure if that was a misprint or not. Mark was preceded in death by his parents, brother Mike, sister Jennifer, and son Jonathan. He is survived by his sister, Jean Sweet, many nieces and nephews, and his grandchildren. He proudly served his country in the Army. Per his request, he was laid to rest in Oklahoma. David Everett Ferguson, 97, of Lisbon, passed away on Saturday, March 9th, at the Rehabilitation Center of Lisbon. Visitation will be from 9:30 to 11 a.m. Saturday, March 16th, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, March 16th, at the funeral home. Private family burial will be at Rose Hill Cemetery. Memorials may be sent to Mechanicsville Fire and Ambulance, Mechanicsville Legion, or a charity of choice. David was born January 27, 1927, to Everett and Gladys Miller Ferguson on the family farm in rural Mechanicsville. He attended country school through the eighth grade, and to continue his education, he attended Mechanicsville High School, where he graduated in 1944. Being only 17 at the time, he enrolled at the University of Iowa. He was a student for a semester until he turned 18 and could enlist in the Navy. He spent time on the USS Grant and the USS Lindenwald. After the end of the war and time served, he was discharged and came back to Cedar County to work on the family farm, a career lasting 40-plus years. In 1947, he met a new-to-town young schoolteacher named Dorothy Bradley. They were married in June 1950 and celebrated 71 years together before Dorothy's passing in 2022. They lived their first years in Mechanicsville until 1953, when they purchased a farm and moved to the country. There they raised two children, Brad and Cindy, and stayed until 2008. They purchased a home in town and moved back to Mechanicsville, where they remained until 2018, when health issues had them relocating to the Rehabilitation Center of Lisbon. Besides farming, Dave was active in many community organizations, American Legion, Lions, and Masons. He was on the boards for the Presbyterian Church, Farm Service, Country Club, Civil Service Commission, Election Poll Worker, and Pioneer Township Trustee, where he served for 61 years. He was the chairman for the Democratic Caucus in Mechanicsville for many years and was a delegate to the county and state conventions several times. Dave is survived by his daughter, Cindy Musselman, grandchildren Carrie Musselman and Seth Ferguson, great-grandchildren Kinsey Ferguson, Colton Ferguson, Kira Ferguson, and Lexi Furry, nieces Chris Weber, Claudia Wallach, and Eliza Wallach, nephew Kurt Ferguson, sister-in-law Cleo Ferguson, and many great and great-great nieces and nephews. David was preceded in death by his wife Dorothy, son Brad, siblings and in-laws Barbara Wallach, Orrin Wallach, Richard Ferguson, Walter Ferguson, Loretta Ferguson, niece Cecilia Ferguson, and nephew Kermit Wallach. The family would like to thank the Rehabilitation Center of Lisbon and CARE Initiatives for their care and assistance. Judith Specht, 81, of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, March 8th at Heritage Nursing and Rehab. As per Judith's wishes, private family services will be held at a later date. Brosh Chapel and the Avava Center in Cedar Rapids is in charge of arrangements. Judith was born November 24, 1942, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Clark and Rosalie Spicer Ludeman. She was united in marriage to Julian Philip Specht on February 28, 1961, in Iowa City. Judy was a volunteer EMT in Cloudcroft, New Mexico, for many years. She enjoyed hiking, collecting butterflies, tending to her cats, and most of all, spending time with her family. Judy is survived by her daughter, Jackie Dennis, her grandchildren, Justin Lusk, Joshua Lusk, Dallas Lusk, and Ronnie Lusk, Keaton Dennis, Wyatt Hyde, Amber Kirk, Kane Armstrong, 9 great-grandchildren, her sisters, Vicki Berger and Janice Taravella, as well as her nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, Julian, and her sons, Jeffrey and David Specht. Memorials may be directed to the family. Virgil C. Minor of Garrison was surrounded by his loving family when he passed away Friday, March 8th, at the Westbrook Acres Nursing Home in Gladbrook following a lengthy illness. He was 92 years of age. Mass of Christian Burial will be 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, March 12th, at St. Mary Catholic Church in Vinton, with Father Jim Brockman as celebrant. Friends may visit with the family from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, March 11th, at Van Steenhuis-Tehan Funeral Home in Vinton, and after 9:30 a.m. at the church on Tuesday. Burial will be private. Virgil was born May 10, 1931, in Luzerne, the son of Corwin and Marie May Fitzgerald Minor. He attended Union No. 9 Country School and graduated from Keystone High School in 1949. On October 15, 1960, Virgil was united in marriage to Rose Mary Jennings at Immaculate Conception Church in Cedar Rapids. She preceded him in death on March 12, 2019. Virgil's employment included farming and automobile repair. He was employed by Fitz Auto Repair, Greenwood Chevrolet, and Irvin's, retiring in 1993. Virgil enjoyed helping his neighbors, farming, fixing tractors and cars, and spent time with his grandchildren. Left to cherish Virgil's memory are his son, David Minor, daughter, Mary Sheely, grandchildren, Alex Minor, Lindsay Minor, Nathan Sheely, and Dylan Sheely, sister Carol Cool, brothers Don Minor and Dale Minor, and several nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his wife of 58 years, Rosemary, son Mark, brother-in-law Dick Cool, and nephew Doug Ness. William Stedman, William Bill Leroy Stedman, 90, of Marion, passed away from this life on Thursday, March 7th at St. Luke's Hospital. Visitation will be held from 12 noon to 1 p.m., with a funeral service to follow on Wednesday, March 13th, at Cedar Memorial in Cedar Rapids. The Reverend Kevin T. Jones will officiate. Private family interment will be in Oak Shade Cemetery in Marion. Bill was born July 20th, 1933, in Cedar Rapids. the only child of Arthur W. and Helena Kleinfelter Stedman. Bill graduated from Franklin High School in 1952. After graduation, he attended Coe College, subsequently enlisting in the United States Army from 1954 to 1956, working as a fleet mechanic. After an honorable discharge, he re-enrolled at Coe College, graduating with his BA. Bill taught at Oxford Junction for a couple of years and then enrolled at the University of Iowa from 1963 to 1964, where he earned an MA in guidance and counseling. After working at Central City High School for a year, he was hired by Vernon Middle School as a guidance counselor, finally retiring from there in 1997. It was at the University of Iowa where Bill met the love of his life, Muriel, Mimi, M. Rundquist. They were united in marriage in 1964 at Kenwood Park Methodist Church and would have been married for 60 years on August 15th. He often said that marrying Mimi was the best thing he ever did. Together they raised two children, Jana and Casey. Bill was very involved with his children's lives. Both were his students at Vernon, and he regularly attended all their events. He was instrumental in fostering a love of reading in them, and they enjoyed many of the same novels. He also enjoyed the outdoors, raising a large garden together with his family, particularly enjoying growing tomatoes. With his daughter, he shared an interest in scary movies, amusement park rides, and a mutual enjoyment in making each other laugh at inappropriate jokes. He accompanied his son shooting and on Boy Scout trips several times. Incredibly proud of the successes of his children and grandchildren, Bill never missed an opportunity to brag about their accomplishments, nor to remind them that he was proud of them. After retiring, he enjoyed visiting his daughter and her family in Colorado, tackling Sudoku puzzles, and reading many types of books, lamenting that there would never be enough time to read all the ones he wanted to. In his earlier years, Bill enjoyed hunting, fishing, listening to all sorts of music from Elvis to Gregorian chants and The Doors, and tinkering with his cars. Bill could strike up a conversation with anyone and loved to ponder the existential question put to him by his first superintendent, Ted Urich, who once asked him, "Bill, what does it all mean?" His family is comforted by the idea that he finally may have his answer, and that when the nurses at the hospital during his last visit asked Bill what he wanted them to know about him, he said, "I am loved." Surviving family includes wife Muriel, children Jana Jones and Casey Stedman, and grandchildren Babalu Jones and Ramesh Jones. Bill's family will miss his warmth, humor, and love, but remember and celebrate his final words, "I am grateful." Okay, we're going to turn to the sports section, and I'll first run through what some of the events are that you can catch on TV or radio. The women's basketball Big 12 tournament is taking place in Kansas City, Missouri, starting today, going on today. On TV this evening in the NBA, the Warriors are at the Spurs at 7 p.m. on NBA TV. The Mavericks are at the Bulls at 7 p.m. on NBCS Chicago. Celtics are at the Trailblazers at 9:30 p.m. on NBA TV. In men's basketball, the CCA tournament at 5 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. on CBS Sports Network. Southern Conference Championship at 6 p.m. on ESPN. Sun Belt Conference Championship is at 6 p.m. on ESPN2. Horizon League Tournament at 6 p.m. on ESPNU. At 8:30 p.m. on ESPN2. I don't know what's on. I'm not sure what that is at 8:30 p.m. But there's something else on at ESPN2. And the WCC tournament is on at 8 p.m. on ESPN and at 10:30 p.m. on ESPN2. In women's basketball, the Summit tournament at 12:30 p.m. and 3 p.m. on CBS Sports Network. The Sun Belt Championship at 1 p.m. on ESPNU. The Big 12 tournament at 1:30 p.m. and 4 p.m. on ESPN2. And the Big East Championship at 6 p.m. on FS1. Pro soccer, Chelsea versus Newcastle United at 3 p.m. today on USA. College track and field, we have the NCAA men's and women's indoor championships at 8 p.m. on ESPNU. On the radio today, you can catch men's basketball, the Southern Conference Championship at 6 p.m. on KGYM. And you can catch the Iowa State women's basketball game in the Big 12 tournament versus Oklahoma at 1:30 p.m. on KGYM. All right, we're going to turn to an article from the front page now. Big Ten men's basketball. Hawkeyes slide down NCAA bubble. Iowa finishes 10-10 in Big Ten after 73-61 loss to Illinois. It's by Mike Klass out of Iowa City. It isn't nitpicking to say Iowa's NCAA tournament hopes took a turn for the worse last night. The Hawkeyes need to do some winning at this week's Big Ten tournament to receive an at-large berth in the NCAA's Field of 68 next Sunday. Just how much, who knows. But it has to start Thursday when, as the number 7 seed, they have a second-round game at 5:30 p.m. in Minneapolis's Target Center against either Ohio State or Minnesota. The Hawkeyes finished 10-10 in Big Ten play with their 73-61 loss to Illinois last night at Carver Hawkeye Arena, snapping their string of four straight winning conference seasons. They are 18-13 overall. Number 12 Illinois is 14-6 and 23-8. The game started about as miserably for Iowa as it could have. Illinois scored the first 10 points, and Iowa missed its first 9 shots. Things got worse for the Hawkeyes before they got better. Illinois led 30-9 with 9 minutes and 31 seconds left in the first half. With freshman guard Brock Harding in the game at point guard, the Hawkeyes pulled back to within 8 points before they closed the half, trailing 39-29. Harding had 6 points, 6 assists, and 2 steals in 12 minutes. Fifth-year guard Terrence Shannon scored 18 first-half points for the Illini and had the defensive play of the game late in the half when he blocked what had momentarily looked like a breakaway dunk for Josh Dix. Illinois had 50 rebounds to Iowa's 33. The Hawkeyes shot just 37.5% from the field. The Illini upped their lead to 43-29 early in the second half, and it grew to 46-32. Iowa closed to 51-47 with 11 minutes 14 seconds left, but Marcus Domask scored consecutive baskets to start an 8-0 Illinois run for a 12-point lead. Conceding nothing, Peyton Sanford sank back-to-back three-pointers to slice the Illini advantage to 59-53 with 6 minutes 58 seconds left. However, the Illini scored the next 8 points and put the game away. Our next story, Big Ten Wrestling Championships. Hawkeyes are sending 9 to NCAA tournament. Iowa has good final day, but no champs. This is by Mike Finn out of College Park, Maryland. After Iowa saw 5 of its 6 semifinalists lose Saturday night at the 2024 Big Ten Wrestling Championships, Coach Tom Brands challenged his wrestlers to fight back and get the next best thing during Sunday's final rounds at the Xfinity Center. And that's what happened. Despite the Hawkeyes seeing their only finalist, Zach Glazier, lose his 197-pound title bout to Penn State's 3-time NCAA champion Aaron Brooks. The senior from Albert Lea, Minnesota, who finished above his number 3 seed, lost 20-3 against the undefeated Nittany Lion. Otherwise, those 5 Iowa semifinalists who came up short on Saturday went a combined 8-2 during Sunday's placement bracket, including 2 who avenged earlier season losses. Overall, 1 Hawkeye finished 2nd, 3 claimed 3rd, 1 4th, and 4 5ths as Iowa qualified 9 of its 10 entries into this year's NCAA Division I championships, which will be held March 21st through 23rd in Kansas City, Missouri. The Big Tens are a qualifier, that's important, Brand said. Our results were not what we wanted, but you can compartmentalize it to where we are going, and that's to Kansas City. Are we going to complain about our past results, or are we going to look ahead and position ourselves the best we can? Overall, the Hawkeyes finished in 4th place with 110.5 points. 2-time NCAA defending champ Penn State, which featured a school record 7 finalists and 5 champs, easily won the team championship with 170 points. The Nittany Lions broke their school record of 157.5 points in 2019. Of the 4 Hawkeyes who reached the consolation final, Drake Ayala at 125, Rial Woods at 141, and Michael Caliendo at 165 won their 3rd place bouts. Ayala, the number 2 seed at 125, topped Purdue's top seed Matt Ramos, who, like the Hawkeye sophomore, was upset in the quarterfinals on Saturday. The Iowa sophomore scored the Bouts' only takedown with 1 second left in the first period to win 4-1. "This will give me confidence going into the NCAA tournament, but I know what I'm capable of," said the Fort Dodge native, who lost to Purdue's 2023 national runner-up 4-1 earlier this winter. Woods, the 2023 NCAA runner-up, avenged an earlier 14-2 loss to Michigan's Sergio Lemley with an 11-8 victory at the Big Tens. The Hawkeye senior jumped out to an 8-1 lead and held off the Wolverine freshman. Caliendo, a sophomore All-American from North Dakota State, scored a takedown with 44 seconds gone in sudden victory to beat Michigan's Cam Amin 8-5. "That takedown was about motion, keep him moving," said Caliendo, whose only loss this weekend was to eventual champ Mitchell Messenbrink in the semifinals. "Once coming up short in the semis was over, the only thing you can do is look forward." Jared Franek, at 157, medically forfeited his third-place bout to Nebraska's Peyton Robb. The graduate transfer from North Dakota State had beaten the Cornhusker in the quarterfinals. In the fifth-place bouts, Brody Teske at 133 pounds and Caleb Rathjen at 149, Patrick Kennedy at 174, and Bradley Hill at heavyweight, ended the 2024 Big Tens with a victory. Teske, now a four-time national qualifier who was seed number 14 this weekend, scored a takedown with 5 seconds left to beat Maryland's Braxton Brown 4-1. The senior missed qualifying for the third-place match when a late video challenge gave Nebraska's Jacob Van Dee a 9-6 sudden victory after officials had awarded the Hawkeye a match-winning takedown in overtime. Rathjen, a sophomore, scored 3 takedowns, one in each period, to beat Ohio State's Dylan D'Amelio, 11-5. Kennedy scored his match's only takedown with 38 seconds left in sudden victory to beat Minnesota's Andrew Sparks, 4-1. Hill, a number 7 seed, ended the night with scoring a second victory over Nebraska's Nash Hutmack. Okay, with a few minutes we have left, I'm going to see how much of the government notes I can read today. We have Cedar Rapids Garden Plot Rentals open Tuesday. Also, do you want to serve on Cedar Rapids Board or Commission? Residents may begin leasing garden plots at Cedar Rapids Park starting Tuesday. Garden space can be leased at the Northwest Recreation Center at 1340 11th Street Northwest. Rentals open at 8 a.m. Tuesday and continue weekdays from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Garden plots have been added to Lincoln Way Park on J Street Southwest as part of the city's plan to expand community gardens and achieve the goals laid out in its Community Climate Action Plan to ensure residents have affordable and accessible options for growing food. Of the 8 new garden sites selected from city parks in the 2023 plan, 2 are now open, Sinclair and Lincoln Way. Future garden spaces are planned at Cherry Hill and Tolkien Parks in the Northwest Quadrant, Knoll Ridge and Twin Pines in the Northeast Quadrant, Huston Park in the Southeast Quadrant, and Reed and the new Westside Library Park in the Southwest Quadrant. 20 standard plots, 10 by 20 feet, are available to rent for the first time this year. Also, 4 ADA raised plots, 3 by 10 feet, with water tanks, are available to rent for the first time. Another 418 plots are available at Ellis Park, Robbins Lake, Tuma Park, Sinclair Park, and near Gardner Golf Course. Sinclair Park includes 4 raised garden beds. Plots at Sinclair and Lincoln Way rent for $21 per plot. Plots at Tumor, Gardner, and Ellis Park are 20 by 50 feet and rent for $42 per plot. We are excited to offer more gardening opportunities in our parks this year, Parks and Recreation Director Hashim Taylor said in a statement. Garden plots have become increasingly popular and sell out quickly. We look forward to providing even more in future years. Plots may be used between the spring and fall growing seasons by renters only. Want to serve on a Cedar Rapids board? The City of Cedar Rapids is looking for people to apply for appointment to a number of city boards, commissions, and advisory committees. The city is committed to gender balance on its boards and committees. The city also encourages individuals who reflect the community's diverse backgrounds to apply. To learn how to apply, visit the city's website at cedar-rapids.org. Applications will be made available to the mayor and council for review. Applications are kept on file for 1 year. Any person who may need modifications modifications for any part of the process, or who has general questions may contact the City Clerk's office at 319-286-5060 or email city-clerk@cedarrapids.org. Applications are due April 30th. Cedar Rapids to debut garage truck art. The Cedar Rapids Solid Waste and Recycling Division will debut its first art-wrapped garbage trucks, 3 recycling and 2 garbage trucks, with work from artists native to Iowa in the coming weeks. In December, the city issued a request for proposals seeking artwork focused on sustainable neighborhoods to be placed on the trucks, a theme inspired by the city's Community Climate Action Plan. The wrap trucks are also part of Cedar Rapids Public Art Plan to promote public art around the city. The city received 37 submissions from local, national, and international artists, according to the news release. The city's selection committee worked with the Public Art Commission to select 5 artists whose work was eye-catching and appealing. The finalists whose artwork will be displayed are Erika Danner, Drew Etienne, Harper Folsom, Chris Sullivan, and Paxton Williams. All are from the Cedar Rapids area, except for Sullivan, who lives in Des Moines. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.